I'm not going to sit down. I'm not going to shut up.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
Shut up, Ron. And I'm Ken Reardon.
Ken, you can shut up too, then.
Well, look, I think we need to get this obligatory Sarah Palin stuff out of the way because everybody, look, she feeds on this stuff. I've made an executive decision that, one, we do not need to talk about Sarah Palin in this podcast, and two, there's a far more important thing to talk about.
Reince Priebus.
That's correct.
I agree with you, Ken. This is the Reince Priebus era.
Do you know if you take out some of the letters in his name, it becomes RNCPRBS?
Do you think it's possible that this is an invented character, that there is actually no human being from Kenosha, Wisconsin named Reince Priebus?
Well, you know, the guy who finished second in the RNC, race for RNC chair, was Mr. Mixie Zipplicht.
Since his smashing election in the rejection of Michael Steele's second term bid, seven ballots, really exciting, very stunning stuff, Reince Priebus emerges as the leader, not a long-winded speaker. He basically thanked everyone for voting for him, said, let's get to work. And he is known as an organizer, known as a fundraiser, probably the perfect opposite of Michael Steele.
Yes and no. I mean, he seems to be very well equipped in merging the establishment wing of the Republican Party with the Tea Party wing. And I think that was actually shown in Wisconsin as well.
He played well with the Tea Party.
Scott Walker, winning governor, and Ron Johnson for the Senate to pick up House seats.
Now, Walker would be more the establishment kind of figure, and Ron Johnson more the Tea Party.
Exactly. And the two of them mesh well, and they won a big victory there.
And they also took, control of the state legislature, and they picked up a couple of seats in the House delegation going back into the majority there. It was a big year for Wisconsin, not to mention the Packers.
I think it's kind of fun that nobody's talking about Tim Kaine's future as DNC chair, and he had a lovely year in 2010.
Just excellent, yeah. 2010, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But obviously it's more important to be the leader of the out party, and nobody cares who the Democratic National Chairman is.
And why is that, Ken?
Because the leader of the Democratic Party is the President of the United States, who is about to have a State of the Union address.
Yes, that is coming up. And interestingly, he steps up to the podium, to the rostrum there in the House chamber for this, his second official State of the Union, third speech at this time of year as president. And he will be addressing a Republican-controlled House of Representatives and far more Republicans, six more Republicans in the Senate. His own trajectory, just personally as a politician, has already begun to show some upward movement since the election in November, whereas a year ago when he stepped to the rostrum talking about health care, talking about a lot of controversial legislation that was pending before Congress, his standing as a politician was slipping.
Right. It had already come after the losses in Virginia and New Jersey, after Scott Brown's win in Massachusetts. The Democratic Party that was riding so high in January, February, March of 2009 was moving downward. But now, I mean, just as Bill Clinton had Oklahoma City, it's very possible that the tragedy in Tucson, the horrific shootings in Tucson, helped elevate President Obama's stature. Now, perhaps Sarah Palin was one reason, because Sarah Palin gave her video address within 24 hours or so of what Barack Obama's had to say in Tucson.
Now, we're not going to back into talking about Sarah Palin.
No,
but there's a reason. I don't think that her videotape helped Barack Obama. I think it probably hurt her a little bit.
But the contrast was stark, I think.
And also the trajectories. The needle has been falling in the Sarah Palin meter for several months. Whereas, since that November election, as the Republicans get more of the limelight, as people see more of the Tea Party candidates in particular who were elected in November, the voters and the general people in polls who are voters and non-voters are a little less certain about those folks. And maybe they're swinging back to reassessing Barack Obama a little bit. And, of course, as you say, he had the timely opportunity of that speech in Tucson, which was widely praised. Even Glenn Beck thanked the president for that particular address. So it's all the fortuitousness of timing.
I mean, obviously, we're not saying that there was anything fortuitous about what happened to Gabby Giffords.
Just timing.
And the timing was exactly right. And again, this would be a very brief moment for him, and things could go bad, sour again. But, you know, it looks like the latest polls show that his numbers have reached across, broken the 50% approval rating, which he has not seen in quite some time.
Really, he has not seen numbers going upward in quite some time.
They've been stagnant for a long time.
That's right. He lost He lost about 2 points per month for the first 6 months he was in office. Of course, he was in the stratosphere right after his inauguration speech.
He had nowhere to go but down.
That's artificial. There was nowhere to go but down.
He had nowhere to go but down.
And he went down, which was the only direction he could have gone.
He could have gone anywhere else.
But now in these new polls by ABC, Washington Post, and the NBC Wall Street Journal polls, widely watched polls, he has gone back up above 50%. And the Republican franchise is slipping a little bit. So the dynamic here is really confusing. The dynamic is fascinating because on the one hand, you have the Republicans feeling very much as though they are on the rise. And certainly in terms of the results of the November election, they are. And at the same time, you have the Democrats feeling a freshened sense of connection with the voting public, or at least with the general public, if not necessarily the voting.
Well, look at the angst that the Democratic Party went through over the health care vote in 2010. You didn't see that this week when the House, of course, you know, voted as Republicans promised. They would vote to repeal the health care measure.
They kept their promise.
And only three Democrats voted with the Republicans on this.
Interesting. I thought there'd be more like 10 or 15.
I thought so, too. And there were only three blue dogs, of course. Of course, most of the blue dogs who voted against health care are no longer to be found in the nation's capital.
Mm-hmm. Also many of the blue dogs who voted for it. I mean, it was a bad election for blue dogs, whichever way they
went. It wasn't. Of course, the irony was these guys in conservative districts were voting against Obama in many ways to protect their seats, and an anti-democratic tide took out, you know, even many of these moderates. But so we are looking back to the president, and remember last year at this time, the president took on the Supreme Court.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
The Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, which really threw the floodgates open on funding of campaigns,
which he thought would rally the Democrats, you know, in anger, but really ultimately, I don't think anybody outside the political professionals paid much attention to it.
Well,
but
a lot of fundraisers did.
Tons of money in 2010, and likely to be much more. We're talking about a $1 billion campaign.
Oh, I don't think there's any question.
No, that's right.
It's not just a guess. I mean, there will be more than $1 billion spent on the political campaigns of 2012, and this is in part. It's going to be, if you will, supercharged by Citizens United. But I think that probably we would have hit $1 billion even without Citizens United.
But President Obama is riding this momentum that he seems to have, and the polls seem to indicate that maybe he takes what he had, the momentum from the Tucson speech, and move it into this State of the Union address, talking about lowering our voices and coming together, and perhaps giving another defense of health care legislation. Now, of course, the Senate is not going to take it up. The House did its, well, who knows?
Mitch McConnell is saying I can force the Senate to take this
in some sense or another.
And Harry Reid is saying I'm in charge here. And it's going to be interesting to see who really is. You know, my guess is Mitch McConnell has to act like this. He cannot cede the leadership of the Senate even to the Senate majority leader, because if he does that, Jim DeMint's going to be right there saying, I will. I'll force the Senate to do something. I'll show you how we can make the Democrats sweat and suffer.
We've seen clearly, I mean, we saw this during the campaign, we saw it during the primaries, that McConnell-DeMint tango is going to be very interesting to maneuver for McConnell and the rest of the Republican leadership.
And I would say also that Harry Reid's got a problem with Chuck Schumer.
That's interesting, too, seeing whether he's looking over his shoulder. I think Harry Reid really distinguished himself this week when he was saying that he has to come back to Washington for the state dinner for President Hu. He says that, well, he's a dictator. And I think it's great that, you know, days before the state dinner, you know, thank God we don't have Sharon Angle in the Senate, because
she'd be an embarrassment.
She says these wacky things.
She'd be an embarrassment.
Well, Harry Reid won that one.
I think our Congress is highly sensitized at the moment to populism, and it is highly sensitized to the notion that we don't want to be too establishmentarian in Washington. So you've got John Boehner refusing his second state dinner. Now, it was one thing when he was a congressman and a member of the minority leadership. Now he's the Speaker of the House. He represents the whole House. He is number three in line to be President of the United States, and he refuses to come to a state dinner. Now, I'm sure he had other things to do, and he doesn't like to work after dark, but look.
You do remember when he missed the Tucson speech, he was attending a Maria Sino fundraiser for the RNC.
It was a rally sort of for her. I mean, I'm not sure they were really raising money, but the point was he was more interested in RNC politics, or he was at least more interested in not being seen on stage as a spear carrier for Barack Obama. He didn't want to be seen as a subordinate in some sort of sense. And he doesn't want to be seen as being pulled around the country by what the president's doing. And in this particular case, I don't think either Harry Reid or John Boehner wanted to be seen as being in some sense or another in thrall to this Chinese leader. That's unpopular in their home states.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is exactly true. I think that you're absolutely right about the dynamic of the U.S.-Chinese relationship. But also it is Boehner as well. I mean, Boehner, comparing him to, like, for example, Newt Gingrich, who would make himself, you know, so prominent in any kind of a state dinner, things like that. Boehner seems to be really the aw shucks. I mean, for the most part, mm-hmm. he's certainly more aw shucks than Newt Gingrich.
Yes, indeed. Some other news, we've already got several senators telling us that they're going to bow out. They're not going to run again in 2012.
Kay Bailey Hutchison, Republican of Texas.
No huge surprise there because
she had
already said she'd rather be governor and she lost the primary.
Yeah,
exactly. And so good.
Although she said she would have resigned, she promised to resign her seat, didn't. And
yeah,
people wondered
times.
Whether, but there's also Kent Conrad of North Dakota.
Chairman of the Budget Committee.
Right.
Very important position.
Somewhat of a surprise, but let's start with the most recent. Joe Lieberman, the independent from Connecticut. Of course, his numbers among Democrats were deadly for years. I mean, because of everything from his support of the war in Iraq.
Support of George W. Bush.
Endorsement of John McCain, trashing
Went
Barack
to the
Obama.
Convention in St. Paul and trashed Barack Obama and endorsed.
Well, a lot of people did, but not many Democrats did.
Yeah, not exactly. Many Democratic senators. Yeah.
The Democratic nominee for vice president in 2000. But, you know, remember in 1998 when he was on the floor of the Senate criticizing Bill Clinton's behavior in the Monica Lewinsky situation.
The president apparently had extramarital relations with an employee half his age and did so in the workplace in the vicinity of the Oval Office. Such behavior is not just inappropriate. It is immoral. And it is harmful.
Now, my argument is that's why Al Gore picked him for vice president.
That's exactly why Al Gore did that.
But a lot of Democrats said enough is enough is enough. But again, could he have run and won as a third party or an independent as he did in 2006? Well, the difference is in 2006, the Republican nominee was a guy named Alan Schlesinger who got a whopping 9.6% of the vote.
He was a non-factor.
The Republicans were really going to back Lieberman. But, you know,
why wouldn't they back him again in 2012?
Well, I think a lot of them were turned off by the don't ask, don't tell stuff. Most part, Joe
Lieberman. Wait a minute, they're going to nominate Linda McMahon again.
Well, then they lose again.
So I don't see any reason why, if I'm Joe Lieberman and I have the rather high opinion of myself that Joe Lieberman might have of himself if I were Joe Lieberman, then why wouldn't I say I can beat whom the Republicans will put up and I can split the Democratic vote again?
Well, I think he's just angry. I think he's been angry since his last campaign in 2006 when Ned Lamont won the primary, when many Democrats deserted him. And, of course, he showed that anger by, one, running as an independent, which is fine. I mean, nobody criticized...
Absolutely his right.
Nobody criticized Lisa Murkowski for losing a primary and running as well.
Many did. Sarah Palin, Joe Miller, quite a few Republicans in Alaska were unhappy. But I agree with you. Yes. I think that there was a substantive difference to the reasoning and to the anger. And there are a lot of people in Connecticut who would never forgive him for that.
Right. I mean, we can compare the, like, Chris Dodd situation. Chris Dodd's numbers were terrible, but Democrats still liked him. Democrats just don't like him. And I think it was a mutual feeling for him. He was just embittered from 2006, and I think part of his behavior in 2008, not so much endorsing McCain, but again, as we said, trashing the Democratic nominee for president of your own ostensible party.
Well, he was the Zell Miller of 2008.
Yeah. Zell
Miller had done something very similar against John Kerry in 2004. For endorsing Bush and trashing Kerry.
This is the man who wants to be the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces. U.S. Forces armed with what? Spitballs?
But there's one thing, Zell Miller, a Georgia Democrat, and from Connecticut, it's, you know, this is...
Former ticket mate.
Exactly, that's what it is.
I think that was really the big thing, is that he had been to the zenith of Democratic national politics, and then to desert the party in that way, so soon thereafter, really. And without there being a clear issue, I mean, he could say the Iraq War, he could say terrorism, I suppose, but it seemed more personal than that. It seemed more like Pekin, it seemed more like it was about 2006.
Democrats, I still think, keep that seat.
Connecticut.
Susan Bisewitz, who's the former Secretary of State, has announced her candidacy, but it looks like the front runner for the Democratic nomination is going to be Congressman Chris Murphy. He's the guy who beat Nancy Johnson in 2006. Very popular, very strong on
swing
healthcare.
Swing district.
But he looks like he's going to be the Democratic nominee. Joe Courtney, another congressman from the eastern part of the state, is also possibly going to run, but it looks like it's going to be Chris Murphy. On the Republican side, it's more confusing.
Yeah, and again, they're probably going to see another run by Linda McMahon. And she lost by 12 points in 2010. I mean, if you lost as a Republican in 2010, you have to think seriously about your viability.
But, you know, she spent $50 million, and she shows no reticence about wanting to spending a lot of money again on 2012.
I think she should get those Meg Whitman advisors from California. They really knew how to spend money and spend it to good effect.
They did. Well, the thing is that you're absolutely right. If a Republican couldn't win in 2010, 2012, who knows what the political atmosphere is going to be like. But look, Richard Blumenthal was kind of a colorless candidate.
Somewhat wounded, too, by the Vietnam stuff. With some issues.
Yeah. Chris Murphy does not have those problems at all. Rob Simmons is another Republican. And Tom Foley, the former ambassador to Ireland, who narrowly lost the governorship in 2010.
I think either one would be stronger, actually. Yeah. I think even without the $50 million, I think either one of those would be stronger in 2012.
Going back to Texas and with Kayleigh Bailey Hutchinson, now there's a lot of Republicans who want to run. Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst is
one of
them.
Seems to be the inside track.
Roger Williams, who's the Secretary of State, has been already endorsed by George H.W. Bush.
Is that good or bad?
Exactly.
In the Texas party of 2011-2012,
Well, who knows, because we've already seen an indication that John Cornyn has already told Jim DeMint to stay out of Texas. You're not from Texas.
That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right.
And we know that the Tea Party
is... That worked in Delaware. Worked in Alaska.
Yeah, and Nevada, too.
And Utah.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I don't think that John Cornyn is going to be able to keep Jim DeMint out of Texas.
No,
it'll have to be other Texans who tell Jim DeMint, don't come in.
But I can't see how that we keep talking about how demographic changes in Texas are ultimately going to favor the Democrats.
2030.
Exactly. We're a long way from it. But the state to talk about is North Dakota.
Yes, and I think North Dakota is good news for the Republicans because they have broken through this longstanding Dakota tradition of voting in a very conservative governor and a conservative legislature, and then sending relatively liberal Democrats relative to the state and their 60% Republican performance in presidential
elections. They always vote Republican, but since 1980, they always elected Democrats until 2010, when Byron Dorgan retired and John Hoeven, the popular governor, winning with 76% of the vote. Congressman Earl Pomeroy, who's been there 9 terms, lost as well.
That's right. And we saw the same dynamic largely in South Dakota over the last couple of elections. Going back over the decade, you get Tom Daschle losing in South Dakota. Very narrow re-election for Tim Johnson. And you also see Stephanie Herseth Sandlin, who was very popular at one point.
Talking about running for the Senate at one point.
Rising star in the Democratic Party. And she lost her office in 2010. So we see this dynamic in the Dakotas that has been fairly strong for a generation or more, suddenly broken in the last couple of cycles. And it looks like 2012 in the Dakotas will probably be another 2010.
Yeah, I agree. For all the talk about what it means in Texas, I think Republicans keep Texas, Democrats keep Connecticut, but North Dakota is probably the big news of the three retirements.
A passing we want to note in the podcast this week, as we often do, Sergeant Schreiber, the Democratic candidate for vice president in 1972.
You know, one of the most important people behind the scenes in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, the war on poverty. He was the first Peace Corps director. He stayed on after President Kennedy's assassination. Of course, he was President Kennedy's brother-in-law, having married Eunice Kennedy. Stayed on with President Johnson. He was President Johnson, I believe, ambassador to France. Rumored to be a possible running mate for LBJ in 64 and for Hubert Humphrey in 68. But every time he ran for office, he failed. He ran briefly for governor of Maryland in 1970, went nowhere. Of course, as you say, he was the vice president of George McGovern's ticket.
And then tried for president in the mid-70s.
But in 72, they lost only 49 out of 50 states.
Mm-hmm. After he replaced Tom Eagleton. They would have been better off if they'd put him on in the first place. Probably wouldn't have won a whole lot of states.
Wouldn't have helped, though. I mean, but McGovern always said that, you know, as down as the Democrats were in that summer of 72, Sergeant Shriver's addition to the ticket at least made it more palatable, even though it was a disastrous defeat for the Democrats. And then, as you say, he ran for president 4 years later, hoping to get labor support and the Kennedy connection, but that went nowhere, and I think he finished fourth or fifth in New Hampshire.
That was an ignominious way to leave politics, but in the subsequent 35 years, the remainder of his life, he was known for being a classy addition to a number of causes that he worked for with his wife and by himself, and somebody who will be missed in a way that many more successful politicians, at least in the sense of being elected to high office, might not be.
He was 95 years old, and he suffered for a long time from Alzheimer's.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
There will be peace in the valley for me, dear Lord, I pray. There will be peace in the valley for me. Well, the bear will be gentle, and the wolf will be tame, and the lion shall lay down by the lamb.